Do you have a perfectly happy, non-dysfunctional family? Everyone gets along. Conflicts are rare. The kids are respectful. They don't misbehave. And better yet, your family has fun together. No, I didn't think so. But we will get some help this hour, and not from all the typical family experts. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday, April 17th. Our guest this hour wondered if his family was falling apart after a scene during a family vacation some years ago, and he went on a quest to find out how to resolve the conflicts and chaos associated with the modern family. And one place that he went to find the answer was the set of the TV show The Modern Family. He also got some advice from the Green Berets, from Warren Buffett, Silicon Valley. We'll find out what he learned from forgetting about the family dinner, to allowing kids to pick their own punishments, to how to go out and play and just have fun. And we'll wonder if you have discovered some non-traditional secrets to raising and being a happy family. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Bruce Feiler, columnist for the New York Times and author of The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, go out and play, and much more. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Joy. Nice to be with you. I'm always honored to be on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, you're so kind. We are honored to have you. You know, I'm sorry to say, but I laughed when I read your introduction where you described the scene at the dinner table at your family vacation. This was an extended family vacation. You had your parents were there and your sister and her family. And it started when you told your nephew to stop texting at the table, at the dinner table. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, I've since learned that moments of transition are among the worst and the likeliest time that fights break out, and it sure seems to happen every year when my family gets together. And so, you know, my wife and I were there with our twin daughters had just turned 5, and we had our own stresses teaching them values and trying to make a family culture. My little sister was there. Her kids are actually older, and as you mentioned, one of them always has a nose and a device, and they were worried about teaching them, which you have to teach adolescents, sex and money and all these drugs and all those issues that they face. And we were gathering together, and I noticed that my nephew was texting under the table, and I was raised right. I know that I'm not supposed to say anything. I absolutely know, but I can't help myself, and I ask him to put his device away, and kaboom, it was like a mushroom cloud erupted. My sister snaps at me not to parent her children. My dad points out that my daughters were the ones balancing spoons on their noses. My grandmother says that from her point of view, none of the grandchildren has any manners. And my wife, at that point, gets up and flees to the kitchen to get ice cream for the kids, which is exactly what her mother would do in that situation. And I said, well, wait a minute, they haven't finished their vegetables. And at that point, everybody basically flees to different corners of the house, and we've all been there at that point about 3 hours, right? And so, as you mentioned, my dad calls me to his bedside. He's in his late 70s, he's ailing, and there was this quiver in his voice that I hadn't remembered hearing before. And he said, our family's falling apart. And basically, just to reassure him, I said, oh, no, it's not. We're stronger than ever. But as I was lying in bed that night, I began to wonder, well, was he right? And by the way, what is the secret sauce that holds families together? I mean, why is it that some families, you mentioned this at the outset, seem to be effective, resilient, and happy, for lack of a better word? And it turns out it's an astonishingly good time to ask that question, because we know much more about families today than we ever knew before. And I went on this quest, as you say, to try to figure out what is it that happy families do right, and what can I learn from them to make my family happier.
Well, why didn't you go to the traditional family experts then? Why did you go talk to the Green Berets?
Because I felt like we're a century after Freud, and I felt like, well, they've had their say, and we've all heard. I mean, if one more person tells me to listen to what my child says and echo back to give them, you know, respect, my head's going to explode. I just feel like we've heard that advice. Turn on a TV, open up a magazine, those the self-help books, they all pile up unread, and yet it's just not changing things. But there is, I think, another reason, Joy, I think that gets really maybe more to the heart of that question, and that is there have been a lot of changes, right? The makeup of the family has changed. We've had women in the workplace, now 2/3 of women, much higher numbers. We also have dads in the family space, dads parenting much more than men ever did in the past. And I think that this new generation of parents realizes that the way that they were raised may no longer apply, but maybe the new rules haven't been written. And we also know that in every other area of society, from business to the military to sports to religion, in all these other areas, there are new ideas, well-tested, well-proven, that can make teams work to bounce back from setbacks, to have the togetherness that families want. And why is it that those ideas are not flooding into families? Why are they isolated in all those other worlds? And so I wanted to go to those worlds, say to parents, what have you taken from your workplace that might, peace negotiators, like, okay, how do you bring peace into family? Like these kinds of issues. What are you trying? What's working? And let me then try them out in my own family.
We are talking with Bruce Feiler. He is the author of The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, go out and play, and much more. So, what's working for you and your family? 1-800-642-1234, or do you need some help? You can send an email, talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So, Bruce, how do we improve our mornings?
Well, I'm not sure the morning I just went through in my house would be a good illustration. But let's talk about mornings, okay? Mornings are the two biggest stress points in families are the hour after everybody wakes up and the hour before everybody has to go to bed. And one of the problems is that parents are constantly badgering, make your bed, brush your teeth, let's go, we're at your school, did you forget your homework? And that is a familiar pattern where, in effect, the parents have all the responsibility and I might even say all the power, and they're constantly putting pressure on children. Well, there is, again, a lot of know-how out there. We have adopted a model in our family that a lot of families are using now. It's based on the idea of agile development, which is a management tool that's been sweeping businesses, and a lot of families are doing it. And the key idea of agile is that you need to be constantly adaptable, right? The system you had in place in September is probably an irrelevance to what you're facing in April. And you need to be able to change and adjust because yesterday I was on a business trip. Today my wife is on a business trip. The dynamic changes. And so we have a couple of things. And on the mornings, what we have adopted now with our kids, and they just turned 8, is a checklist where there's a list of things that we've all agreed that they have to do, make their bed, set the table, clear the table, brush their teeth, etc. And instead of constantly saying, have you done each of these things, we have empowered them that they have to check off the list. And you mentioned this idea of pick your own punishments. We have discussed, okay, well, if you don't do it, what's going to be the consequence? And we engage them in this conversation. And we have this engagement in one of the biggest, most consequential things that we've done, and maybe the most talked about idea since my book came out a number of weeks ago, and that is we have a weekly meeting, 20 minutes every week, where we talk about how our family is functioning. And we basically ask 3 questions. What worked well this week? What didn't work well? And what will we agree to improve on and focus on in the week ahead? And then we pick 2 things, and then we work on them each week. And the idea is, you need a time where you can be mindful about how you're working as a family. So say this morning when my wife was sick for this business trip,
I'm sorry,
and I had to make breakfast this morning, which was not on the schedule, you know, it was a little bit of a challenge. We had to scramble, but rather than having the fight in the moment, you say, you know what, we're going to push anything off to the family meeting, and then we're going to discuss how it is that we're working as a family.
That's funny. It sounds like our post-mortem, but we have it every day after the show. What worked well? What didn't? What do we want to work on to improve?
Well, that's in fact part of the idea. So it's working for you in the mm-hmm. workplace. Why are we not doing these things at home? I mean, I think this is kind of a core part of what I found, and that's really affected us in a positive way in our family, and that is we have our jobs, and we all know we have to work on those. We have our hobbies. We all know your tennis game is not going to get better unless you work at it. We have our bodies, and we all know we have to work on those. There is this idea out there that families somehow are just organic, and they just are. And that's the problem, and it's just committing to focusing on the family, even for a little bit of time, it can have huge positive benefits for everybody in the family.
Now, you actually say that every family or family should consider having an agile family manifesto. What are the key points to that?
Well, the key point is, number one, is that you need to adapt all the time, right? And so, as I said, you need to understand. One of my favorite lines about parenting comes from a friend of mine who had 4 kids under 6, and his line was, with children, everything is a phase, even the good parts. Mm-hmm. So just when the kids stop teething, they start having tantrums. Just when they stop needing our help taking a bath, they need our help dealing with online bullying. I thought as a parent, okay, I'm going to set a few rules and we'll stick to them. It doesn't really work that way. I can elbow my kids around and get them to do something, but maybe once or twice. It's not building up patterns. If you want to prepare your child, you can't just get your kid to 16 and say, go forth and make decisions. You want to engage them in the process. And so if plank number one of the Agile Family Manifesto is adapt, plank number two is empower your children. Bring them into the conversation where you're giving them more responsibility, especially when they're younger, because in some ways the stakes are lower. I mean, they seem higher when you're late for school, as mm-hmm. it seemed this morning here. But at the same time, the stakes are lower, and you want to, what's working for you, what's not? Bring the children into this feedback loop. And we now know that kids who set their own schedules, plan their own work, if you have them evaluate their own progress, like make checks on their own checklist or whatever it may be, that's building up their brains. Their prefrontal cortexes, we know from scans, are actually getting bigger when they're taking this responsibility, and that will allow them to take more responsibility in their lives, to be more independent, which, of course, is the ultimate golden ticket we want as parents.
When you talk about letting kids pick their own punishment, you mean that? That, you know, if they do, they somehow misbehave, that they can decide what happens to them?
Everybody who hasn't done this thinks that the kids will pick lax punishments. Anybody who's done it know that kids are incredibly strict on themselves. Our girls are little Stalins. We're constantly having to dial them back. But yes, in our family meeting, we say, okay, we're going to work on respect. For example, this week, respecting your elders, which is a problem that we have. I'm sure you don't have that problem,
no.
But it's a problem we have. And if you respect us, you give us the reward. If you don't, if 3 times you speak to us in a kind of a sassy, disrespectful way, which we have with our daughters, then you're going to pick the consequence. And we have this conversation together because I can't always predict what's going to motivate them or not. And I want them, again, back to the golden ticket idea here, I want them to be intrinsically motivated. That's my desire. Engaging them in this conversation gives me access to their inner lives, helps them take more responsibility, and it has been shown in many, many families. The research absolutely backs this up, and we've become believers. Empower your children. Park the helicopter parents. Engage them in the conversation. Your family will run better.
So should we think of our family as a team, like a business group or military unit?
Well, I think that there are, I mean, it's a fine line. On the one hand, you do want some parental authority, but on the other hand, yes. I mean, for example, the way I was raised growing up in Georgia in the 1970s, my dad always sat in one chair and mom in a chair, and the kids had assigned seats. We actually rotate the seats now. We actually... because we don't want to lock in these positions that men always do this and women always do that. And, you know, we can get into this when we get into the play aspect of this, but yes, you want on as many occasions as possible to flip the power structure, to let your children take the lead in a game or let your children start an activity, let your children pick, you know, set the schedule, because that will actually give them the skills that you want them to have. So I think that in many cases, if it's worked, I mean, look, we know that you wouldn't put a kid in a car without a car seat. We know you wouldn't smoke in front of a child when they're pregnant if you can help it. We know that you wouldn't put a kid on a bike without a bike helmet. We actually do take knowledge and change how we are in families. And right now, a lot of the most interesting research is being done with teams and sports teams and the militaries about how to make groups cohere. And part of what I'm saying is, if that's worked and families have been shown to work, my wife was very clear when I set out on this project, The Secrets of Happy Families. She said, I don't want theory. If you show me that actual families are doing it, then I'm actually willing to try in our family. But a lot of families are doing this, and what I've just tried to do is put all these new ideas into one place for parents who just don't have access to go to all those different sources.
Bruce Feiler is author of The Secrets of Happy Families, and we're welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming your own secrets. What's your secret to family happiness? Have you tried any of these techniques that we're talking about? Do you have weekly family meetings? Do you let your kids set their own punishment or what? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up a little bit later today, it's At Issue, and John Munson will be talking with his guests about the issues of the day. Right now, we are talking about the issues facing the modern family and how to reduce conflict and chaos and discord that might be in your family life. Talking with a guest who went on a quest to find out the secrets of happy families. And Bruce Feiler is with us this hour. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You know, Bruce, back in my day, we often had family dinners. My mom is very important to her. We had to get everybody around the table and maybe even force the issue more than more. That caused some conflict too. But you're saying forget about that?
Well, family dinners are great. We have a lot of research that shows, and parents have certainly been told, if there's one thing you can do that's good for your kids is have dinner together. The problem is that it doesn't work for a lot of families. A third of us are not doing it regularly. Americans rank 23 out of 25 countries in terms of family dinners together. And my wife, for example, often doesn't come home until 6:30 from her job. Mm-hmm. And so, but you dig deeper into the research, and it's quite fascinating and quite helpful for families. And that is, nothing has been more studied than family dinner. Every like has been taped and chronicled and analyzed. And it turns out there is only 10 minutes of conversation in any meal. 10 minutes. The rest is taken up with take your elbows off the table and pass the ketchup.
Stop texting.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And blow on it if it's hot. Mm-hmm. Whatever it might be. And what the research shows is that you can take that 10 minutes is what really matters. And you can take that 10 minutes and move it to other times of day and still have the same benefit. So if you can have family dinner, fantastic. But if you can't, try family breakfast. Try meeting for a bedtime snack. Even one meal on the weekends has been shown to have benefits. And because what's really about here is the talking time. And so what we did, as you know, is that we tested several dozen different dinner table conversation starters to see what is most effective among people of different generations. And maybe you have an aunt or an uncle or a friend over. And I put my favorite five in The Secrets of Happy Families. I call them the Hunger Games, and things that you can play. For example, you can play a simple game of bad and good, where everybody goes around, says what happened bad to them that day, and then goes around and says what happened good to them that day. And when we first started playing this, my wife, who is a very upbeat person, she said, oh, nothing bad happened to me today. But part of it is you want to model for your kids that bad things happened to you and you got through them. And letting your children see in real time how you solve problems is actually very beneficial for children. We play a game now. Fascinating to see how this worked. I read that kids, beginning in first grade, have to learn 3,000 words a year. And you can help by teaching your child one new word a day. Okay, so when they're babies, you want to speak baby talk because that's how they learn to speak. But then as they get older, you actually want to speak more like yourself. Actually, don't dumb down your language. You'll help your children. So one way to do this, we heard, and my wife really liked this, was to bring a newspaper or a magazine. Catalogs are great. J. Crew catalog has so many colors that no one's ever heard of. And you teach your and we were teaching our kids a new word, and that was our goal. Well, then it turned out that our kids know all this slang from their classrooms that we didn't know, and suddenly they wanted to teach us new words. And so number one complaint of parents is that they don't have access to what their kids are thinking or feeling. How's school? Fine. How are your friends? You know, what'd you do today? Yeah. So this activity, which we began as an exercise to teach them words, and we stumbled into this great conversation that was actually going two-way. Everybody benefits.
Cool. As you can tell, I need new words. What?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Hello. I don't know if you need new words, children, but you need new words when you talk to me.
Well, very cute. Do you have a new word for us? Totes, maybe?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny. I'm trying to think of what of a new word that we have learned recently from our children that was an example of something. That, you know, texting is great for this. Our girls are too young to text, but the slang, I mean, there's all this YOLO, I mean, all this kind of stuff that the parents have no idea that the children know. If you have a teenage boy, I'm sure he can teach you some World of Warcraft or Magic the Gathering word. I follow my 13-year-old nephew on Twitter, and I'm constantly writing back, I didn't understand a single word that you used in that tweet.
Let's go to Linda in Brookfield. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good morning. Morning. This actually ties in a little bit to that dinner conversation we were talking about, is the food battle that I see happen in my own family. I have a 9-year-old daughter, as well as families all around me, and how different parenting approaches are taken. So, for example, I have seen friends who will ask their child to have 6 more bites of their broccoli before they can finish dinner and have dessert. Where I tend to have my child, based on some of my childhood experiences, I allow my child to make a lot of her own choices, which means that some days are not great nutrition days, but they're choices that she's made. And then I'm always impressed when I see her at dinner actually choose to grab a big bunch of broccoli and eat it, or run to the kitchen and grab a big apple or two and eat that rather than the cookies I also have sitting on the counter. I didn't know what kind of studies or what you have seen happens when you create those different types of choices versus kind of dictating what they're eating.
Well, I have two responses to that wonderfully described scenario. And one is about the food issue, but the other is about the parenting issue. And let me work my way toward the second one. You know, as for the food issue, this has been, I would say, a struggle in our home. Our girls are you know, on the picky side of the gamut. And my wife and I travel a lot, and it's very hard for us to stomach. So the research shows that you should put the food on the plate, not necessarily insist that they eat it. I recently talked to the head of the Yale Parenting Center about the issue of bribing, and he was saying that that one technique that I've adopted that can be very helpful is to say to young children, and I do this with my daughters now, oh, don't worry. When you're older and more mature, you'll want to eat the broccoli. And suddenly there's just a tiny little bit of competition of, like, sooner or later you'll grow up. And what do you mean I'm not grown up? What do you mean I'm not mature? And put the onus more on them. But what I was really thinking about when you were asking that question is what happened when parents disagree. Because my wife is a big fan of the 3, 4, 5 more bite approach, and I am not. And I am just sort of eat it, and you know, we'll know it when we'll all know it when you're done. And I see this a lot, and that parents have different approaches. I tend toward the more controlling parenting style, and my wife tends toward the more lenient parenting style. And what do you do? And part of what has been successful about this agile approach, this idea of bringing our kids into the conversation, of trying to resolve these issues in public in a meeting 20 minutes once a week, is that it allows everybody to have a voice and a parent, in effect, to work out their own style. And I think that this, I was mentioning earlier, if you were listening from the top of the hour, that there two of the big changes that have gone on in the American family is that women are working now and therefore are more stressed for time when they come back, and men are much more involved in parenting, which means this idea of parenting, parents disagreeing, is a much bigger part, in a way, of families today than it was in the past. There's a chapter in my book, The Secrets of Happy Families, where I went and spoke to the folks at the Harvard Negotiation Project about how to fight smarter, both how my wife and I could fight smarter and how we could resolve fights among our children in a more effective way. And these negotiators, they deal with Israeli-Palestinian peace talks and Northern Irish and central strikes in third world countries. And Bill Urey, who wrote Getting to Yes, who founded, basically invented negotiation studies in the 70s, said to me that ours is the first generation where everything is negotiated, right? In the past, Dad had his role, Mom had her role, the kids had her role. So now, he said to me, realize that you and your wife, everything has to be negotiated. Who's doing what? Who's getting up with the kids? Who's ordering the shin guards for soccer? Who's taking grandma to the eye doctor? Whose turn is it to do the morning? What, everything has to be negotiated, he said. Realize that you're pioneers, that will give you a break and allow you to calm down and realize it's kind of like I said earlier, the old rules no longer apply, but the new rules haven't been written.
Yeah, you wrote a piece in that was in the New York Times this week on domestic diplomacy.
Yes.
And it was interesting, even when it comes down to the chair that you sit in. You should sit in a cushioned chair and not a wooden chair if you want to be more flexible.
This is one of my five favorite ideas from The Secrets of Happy Families. I had these environmental psychologists who study how our spaces affect how we live. And she was explaining to me, and I eventually have now seen the research that shows if you're sitting at a hard, rigid surface or at a desk or on a hard surface, you'll be more rigid. If you're on a cushioned surface, you'll be more flexible. And she said to me, when you're having a tough conversation with your children, you should sit on a cushioned surface. So I, right now, happen to be sitting in my bedroom in Brooklyn, and I am looking at a window seat that happens to be under our window. It has a cushioned surface. So when my wife and I have disputes, we now have them there. We used to be in my office. I would be high at a desk with my computer equipment. She was in this old swivel chair, and she was resentful because I was in what's called the power position.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know there was such a thing as the power position.
You're up higher.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I'm mm-hmm. higher. I have all this firm stuff that shows that I'm the dominant one. And she's got her arms crossed and is feeling resentful. When we went through my daughter's report card not long ago, their first semester report card, we did it on that cushioned surface. We sat on the same side with them because that shows we're on their side, and said, look, this is what's great, but you have a few things to work on, like any report card. And we are pushing them. I don't want to say we're being tough on that, but we're pushing them. We're being realistic with them, but we're also communicating this isn't a hostile situation. We're with you, but we want you to work on these things that your teacher wants you to work on, because we now know if you're sitting alongside someone, you'll be more collaborative. Across from someone, you'll be more confrontational. And the point is, look, this may not work with your family. I'm not saying anybody should do any of these things. What I'm saying is there are new ideas out there. I've put 200 in my book. I'd be stunned if you couldn't find three that could make your family happy.
Bruce Feiler is a columnist for the New York Times and author of The Secrets of Happy Families, Improve Your Mornings, Rethink Family Dinner, Fight Smarter, Go Out and Play, and much more. 1-800-642-1234 if you would like to add some more ideas or ask a question. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Blake in Superior has been waiting. Hi, Blake.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm pretty good.
Good. Well, I just wanted to make a comment. You talked earlier about letting kids choose their own punishments, and I'm not a parent yet, but I used to be a kid who was disciplined in this way. And when I was, I'll give you one example. One time I had forgotten to do my homework, quote unquote forgotten, and I went, my mom said, what do you think we should do about this then? And I'll tell you what, nothing sinks your stomach more as a child than hearing that. over you're grounded.
Oh, so you that was worse, to say what should we do about this rather than her just telling you.
Yeah, because then it makes you, you almost want, when you're a kid, you almost want to give yourself a bigger punishment because you feel this disappointment that you're just disappointed your mom, you know, and you just, so I would fire back with, I should probably be grounded for a week. And then she would say, well, I don't think it was that big of a deal.
So what punishment did you give yourself, Blake, for forgetting to do that homework?
Well, she ended up negotiating me down to one day.
Well, what about that, Bruce? I mean, there was negotiation involved there, too.
It echoes exactly what I was saying earlier about the families who haven't done it think the kids will be lax, and anybody who's done it knows the kids will be strict. But more to the point, that's not really the standard here. We're not judging this by how strict mm-hmm. or lax the punishment is. We're judging it by having your child develop the skills to be independent, which is what we want. We don't want our children if they're 24 or 27 in a job and they're not doing their job, they can't blame the parent, right? I mean, and what Blake just said, it was so perfect. It perfectly captured the tension because mother says do your homework, child doesn't do homework, mother grounds child. At that point, child is upset with the mother for the punishment as opposed to focusing on the why didn't I do my homework, or as Blake just said, I quote-unquote forgot to do my homework, right? And the point is we want our kids to be independent, and I think that what we see time and again is that contemporary parents, because they're stressed, because they're out of time, because they're in a hurry, because that email is waiting and that call has to be made and that trip to Amazon has to happen, whatever it might be, they want to do it for the child because it's quicker and easier. But this other approach where you're actually allowing the child to take responsibility is in everybody's interest. It oddly takes more time, so it's more effortful, but the benefit is much higher.
Alice in Milwaukee is with us now. Hello, Alice.
Hi there.
I understand you have a lot of experience at this.
Well, I'm a mother of 10.
Oh,
and
my word.
They're all age 50 or above now, and I wanted to say that some of these things he's talking about were very successful. All 10 were under 14. My husband was busy working in ball games, and I had the responsibility of rearing them. So I had two lists on our little bulletin board. One was punishments, and the kids helped me make up this list. And the other one was chores. And for the punishments, if they would do something, I would have them go to the list and pick out what was their punishment. If it was not good enough, I figured, for what they did, then I added to it. If it was too harsh, which most of the time they would pick out too harsh, then we would negotiate on that. And on the other list of chores, with as many in our family as they got to be teenagers, it took 5 pounds of potatoes for a meal. So once a week, they had to have the 5 pounds of potatoes peeled when I came in from my job. And I had to get dinner ready in an hour and 15 minutes because of all the sports they were into and everything. At the table, everything was put on the table. You took the dish in front of you and passed it to the left. If there was chicken, you took a good piece and a bad piece. And
right.
So everybody got a good piece and a lesser piece. And there were many things that we did.
To try to make sure that there wasn't a lot of discord there. Thank you so much, Alice. So it sounds like some of these ideas are not brand new, Bruce.
Some of these ideas are not brand new. Some are brand new. Mm-hmm. We do have new knowledge. We have one thing that we have that Alice didn't have access to when her children were her 10 children were some of them were in the teenage years. Is, as I said, the brain scans. The point is. That we have a lot of knowledge now, and we can some of the things that Alice did, like I said, putting kids on bikes without helmets, perhaps that was done at that time. We've learned a lot, and some are timeless. And I went out to ask a simple question. what is it that happy families like Alice's do right, and mm-hmm. what can I learn from them? And one of the things that's interesting that we know is it's paradoxical, but families with more children actually say that they're happier than families with young children. And I think one of the reasons is, as we've just heard, she couldn't do everything for everybody. She had to have them more involved. They had to become more independent, help one another, because she was working, her husband was working, and it would have been chaotic if the parent had to do everything. And what a great story. And I'm delighted to hear her that she got through that amazing experience with 10 kids under 20, it sounds like.
So what should we do to go out and play more?
Well, I think that I'm glad you brought up play, mm-hmm. and because maybe the biggest lesson of play is that the research clearly shows that families should spend less time worrying about what they do wrong and more time focusing on what they do right. And if we make those positive memories, it will actually outweigh the negative memories. This is very easy to say, and yet we don't make time for it. I mean, I went to see the folks talk about new knowledge. I was playing 20 questions with my kids one day as we were driving to Grandma's house, and I thought, why are we playing this 100-year-old game? It was a radio game in the 1930s. Haven't we learned anything about games? And I thought, well, who knows this? And I went to see the folks at Zynga, the online gaming people in San Francisco. They invented Farmville, which is the Facebook game, Words with Friends, these other online mm-hmm. games. And they designed a bunch of new games. And we know, for example, that boys and girls play games for different reasons. Boys like the points and the levels up, by and large. There's another category, and those are called achievers. But there's another category that are called decorators. Tends to be girls, not all girls, but they like to tell stories and decorate things and work more cooperatively. And so they designed games for me, which I have in the book, about, you know, an example of a decorator game. And I have girls, is we do a lot of storytelling. So we're sitting in an airport, and the plane is delayed, say, and we say, okay, well, who's that person, and where have they come from this morning? What did they have for breakfast, and where are they going? When we're driving in a car, we'll do this person starts the story, and that person adds an element, and then we create a sort of, okay, well, if we can make the story work in 10 sentences, then we'll give ourselves a prize. But we know a lot more about games, and that's an example of how we can play smarter.
Talking with Bruce Feiler, who is author of The Secrets of Happy Families, Improve Your Mornings, Rethink Family Dinner, Fight Smarter, Go Out and Play, and much more. If you have a question for him or an example of how you're employing some of these techniques, or maybe you have your own secret to your happy family, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up, within President Obama's federal budget are proposed cuts to Social Security. Kathleen Dunn and her guest after 9 will detail how these cuts would be made and the future of Social Security. We are talking about the secrets of happy families with Bruce Feiler, who's a columnist for the New York Times and the author of a book by that name, The Secrets of Happy Families. And Jeff in Milwaukee is with us next. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning. Yes, I'm just wondering if part of your study took a look at the role of faith in raising the family, and also a challenge to take a look at the book of Proverbs. There's 30 Proverbs in the Bible. Reading one proverb a day, I think, is very beneficial.
Thanks for your call. As you may know, I've written a lot about religion. I'm the author of Walking the Bible and Abraham, and there is a chapter in The Secrets of Happy Families on religion. And it's interesting that the research, this is something the research has consistently shown for decades, that people who identify themselves as being more religious do also identify themselves as being happier, and it's a kind of puzzle in the research, and we don't know exactly why. There was a research out of Harvard in the last couple of years that began to show this, and so we've seen that began to answer this question in an interesting way, because everybody who's looked at this has found that it doesn't matter what religious belief system you have, it doesn't matter how often you go to religious services or don't go to religious services. It doesn't even matter whether you believe in God as to whether you're happy or not. What the research suggests is that one of the reasons, one thing that we've learned from the positive psychology movement in the last 10, 12 years is that happiness is relationships. And in a lot of ways, happiness is other people. And people who identify themselves as being religious often are in a community, and it is that sense of being in a community that helps make you feel grounded, that helps make you happier. The research shows that it's 10 people is the sweet spot. If you belong, if you're involved in a religious institution, and if you know 10 people in that institution, you'll say that you're happier. So that's what it shows. In Happy Families, in my book, The Secrets of Happy Families, I talked to Gary Chapman, who is a Baptist preacher from North Carolina and the author of The Five Love Languages, who talked about, because another thing that religion does is it emphasizes things like joy and forgiveness and some of these other qualities. And these are very important to families. The research suggests that actually being supportive for somebody when they achieve something is actually more important than being supportive for them when they have something go wrong. There's a wonderful study called Will You Be There for Me When Things Go Right? That shows that helping celebrate someone's achievement, especially if you attribute that achievement to the person. So, Joy, you and I are married, and you come home and you say you got a promotion. Mm-hmm. So I can say, oh, congratulations, but that's not cutting it. If I say, oh, my God, this is wonderful, of course, it's because you worked hard. It's because you work well with others. It's because you're really if I actually attribute your promotion to your actual individual contributions, then that's a sign of a healthy relationship.
Yeah, I'll appreciate that more. Matt in Menominee Falls is with us now. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Something that I had heard years ago and applied it to our family is a phrase, goes something like this, rules without a relationship equals rebellion. And, you know, so the time that we spend with our kids, developing a relationship, you know, the rules seem to be applied with the kids a little, you know, they seem to take it a little easier. And
what do you mean by the relationship, Matt?
Well, if you just apply rules, and I think that's kind of what I'm hearing in this program anyway, mm-hmm. but if you just apply rules and, you know, then go away, you know, do your chores and leave me alone, there's not a relationship there at all. And essentially it will lead to some sort of rebellion is the concept or theory, I guess. But if I apply rules, you know, if I have a set of rules in the family and then, you know, we apply those rules and we go out and we play ball, play catch, develop a relationship with the kids, the idea anyway is that hopefully you don't have a rebellious family.
All right. Rules without a relationship equals rebellion, Bruce.
Well, I think that it does echo, you're right, I think that it does echo a lot of the ideas that are in my book and that I found while working on The Secrets of Happy Families. Happy families, from what I found, have three things in common. They adapt all the time. They talk a lot, and they don't just have difficult conversations, as important as those are. They also talk about what it means to be part of a family. But then they go out and play. And to kind of reprise what I said earlier, the research suggests that if you should spend less time worrying about what you do wrong and more time focusing on what you do right. Because as the caller suggests, if you do make that bond, if you do make that connection, it will help. I mean, I'll just give you one example. That's my single favorite idea from my research, and that is the importance of telling your family history. Researchers at Emory gave kids a test. Do you know where your grandparents were born? Do you know where your parents went to high school? Do you know an aunt or an uncle who had an illness that they overcame? And the kids who knew more about their family history had a higher sense of self-confidence and a greater belief that they could control their own lives. It was the single biggest predictor of a child's emotional well-being. And what the researcher said is that the kids understand that they are part of something bigger than themselves, an intergenerational self. and so that they know when they hit a hard time, if they have that bond that the caller was talking about, if they know, my uncle lost his job and my grandfather was sick and had to take a few years off, or that my parents had a hard time that they overcame, it gives kids confidence that they can overcome their own difficult moment, because all kids are going to have difficult moments.
So I
fully agree that the bond is incredibly important, because you're going to have to push your kid. Eat the broccoli, get out the door, do your homework. You're going to have to discipline your child. If you can do it from a position of a strong connection, then they're going to know more. They're still going to be upset. They may even rebel, but they're going to know that it comes from a position of love, and that's what you want.
Wow, that's fascinating. Say, I wanted to ask you, what did you learn when you went to the set of The Modern Family?
Well, I loved going to Modern Family, which is fun. I mean, I learned how hard. I learned it's a lot easier to have a happy family if you have 14 writers writing your script,
yeah,
and,
right.
You know, and someone fixing your hair and doing your makeup every day and cleaning up after you. That's one thing I learned. One thing about sitcoms that's interesting is that there is, we're in this phase. And one thing I learned is the importance of family today. Right? It used to be back in the day, right, that sitcoms would end with a hug, and the family would have conflict, but the family would come together. But that became out of favor. It was Seinfeld, Married with Children. There was a lot of these caustic comedies about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But now Modern Family single-handedly has kind of brought back the idea of a loving family. The makeup is different. Obviously, you've got a gay family. You've got second marriages. You've got international. You've got mm-hmm. international marriages. You've got every configuration imaginable. But yet, it also, at 22 minutes, the music swells, everybody hugs, and everybody comes together. But the main thing I learned, maybe, is that I didn't fully realize this about sitcoms, that the characters don't really change, right? So the next week, they may have that hug, and they may have a little micro-learning thing that they've achieved, but the next week they're going to have the same problem again. And that's so exactly what it's like to be in a real family, right? You can have that learning. You can have that teaching moment. You can have that wonderful experience. But darn if the next morning we're not having the same problem all over again. And I think that trying to have each encounter end with a positive experience, but also lowering your expectation about how much people are going to change, that's actually not a bad lesson to learn from TV.
Let's go to Kathy in Madison. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Well, I like the way this conversation has turned the last 20 minutes onto happiness and relationships. In the beginning, talking so much about everybody doing their own job, I didn't like that part so well. That should be a no-brainer, just like potty training should be a no-brainer. The child comes to you with a full diaper because the child knows that you're going to take care of it, and the child is aware. At that point, it's time. And it's just like that with every other job the child does. The child likes his bed smooth. The child learns to do it. You make it easy for the child, and you get that all done. We used to have our kids lay out their clothes the night before. Each kid had a little pile. We raised 5 kids.
Yeah.
Their first two are 3 years apart, and the next ones are 4 years apart, and they all learned responsibilities bit by bit.
Yeah, so let's not talk about the chores and having fun in the family doing things together.
Right. We played all kinds of games together. The kids did not have TVs in their rooms until after graduating high school, if they managed to stay at home after that, and most of them did not. But we did not have the kinds of distractions that people have nowadays that require more supervision.
Thank you very much, Kathy. We only have a minute to go, Bruce. What's the takeaway from your book?
Try. This echoes what I said earlier. We have our jobs, we have our relationships, we have our gardens. We know we have to work on things, and yet somehow we have this idea that families are just naturally are. And if you can take one thing away from that, it's to realize that if you make mindful time, if you spend time thinking about how your family is functioning, we know there are chapters in The Secrets in Happy Families on how to deal with money, how to deal with sex, how to deal with difficult conversations, how to deal with grandparents, how to deal with adult siblings, how to deal with dinner, how to deal with travel. And what I have found is that happiness is not something that we find. It's something that we make. Anybody who's looked at well-run groups knows it's not a matter of circumstance. It's a matter of choice. You can take small steps. you can accumulate small wins, you can make your family happier, and everybody in your family happier.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Bruce Feiler, columnist for the New York Times, author of The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, go out and play, and much more. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, Amanda Magnus, and Rob Barrett for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.